live in hell.
This is what real hope looks like. This is the word that those hopeless people need to hear. This is the word that 3,000 people that try to commit suicide today, the 3,000 that will try to commit tomorrow, 3,000 that will try to commit on Monday, this is the word that they need to hear, is that there is hope.
It's real superpower. It's hope. There's hope. It needs hope.
Welcome to Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. I am your host, Captain Nostalgia, and we are dedicating this episode to everyone that has been affected by the Waco siege. It's 25 years later, so if you guys are listening to this, this episode goes out to you guys. But I couldn't be talking about such a history-changing moment alone. So please help me in welcoming the ladies behind the Crazy Clinic podcast, a.k.a. part two of our Waco crossover, Megan and Alex.
Hey! How's it going?
It's going good. How are you guys?
Pretty good. Has been quite a day.
Yes, indeed.
I understand. So tell us a little bit about the show.
Oh, well, we are the Crazy Clinic Podcast, the podcast where we talk all about you. Basically, we break down people's fears, thoughts, habits,
weird pet peeves.
Yeah. Anything you do and think that you find weird or your friends find weird, and we dig into the psychology aspect of it and tell you just how crazy you really are and maybe why.
Now, usually a concept like this is something that might some people might find a little alienating because you're essentially inviting people in to point out their flaws, but you guys actually took the first step in there and said, look, we're here with you guys. The first couple episodes that you guys have done have actually revolved around your guys' own phobias. So what's the experience been like kind of being vulnerable with your listeners right off the get-go?
Oh, boy. Well, we felt that it was important because we are asking people to maybe put themselves out there a little bit. We originally, before we even recorded, kind of went on social media and asked people to give us their stories. And we didn't have the best turnaround. I had a couple people.
Yeah.
But we decided to put ourselves out there to let people know that we have weird shit going on, too.
Right?
And that it's okay. And later on, if down the road, if we have to do more with one of us, we'll probably cover it. So people aren't alone in their weird stuff, and they need to know that. So we sacrificed ourselves in our weird stuff.
SBSV. Vulnerable, yeah. One more time for our listeners. So tell us a little bit about the phobias that you guys have discussed in the episodes so far.
Well, our first two episodes, years, and mine was moth phobia, which is fear of moths.
Yeah, and mine is trypophobia, which is the fear of irregular patterns of holes or bumps.
And that just recently started getting in.
Yeah, I just recently picked that one. A wonderful gal from our group, Valerie, who gave us her story of her fear of advanced AI. So episode 3 is about advanced AI.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 4, we decided to go a little bit more on the serious side, and we talked about dissociative identity disorder, more commonly known as multiple personality disorder. And that was our kind of serious episode to maybe let people know that we do talk about the serious stuff, so everything can be talked about on our show.
Fears you're usually hearing about, arachnophobia is a big one. My big one is snakes. I hate snakes. But my... I think also another that, coming with, being a, 6-7 months out from the recent It remake, we also got, a lot of people are afraid of clowns as well. So, you guys are kind of really stepping into territory that not a lot of people are talking about as far as fears go. What are some of the weirdest fears that you guys have kind of come across in your research so far?
Megan, I'll let you go ahead and take that one first.
I actually wasn't even looking up fears. It was weird. And on Google, it had there's a fear. I don't know the like medical name for it because it was really hard to say. But it said a fear of running out of wine, like your glass wine.
I have that wine. Daily.
Yeah, like I was like, wait, there's somebody who's actually
afraid
of it.
You can be pretty much afraid of anything.
Yeah,
but to classify it as a phobia, it must be pretty severe.
Mm-hmm.
I think the weirdest one that I've come across would be people being afraid of their own genitalia. And so, I mean, they clearly go from having your wine glass being empty to something that you can't exactly just remove from yourself. So fears cover everything. Right. And it's good to do the weird fears so people remember that. I mean,
because you're deathly
afraid your wine glass is going to be empty doesn't mean that you don't count.
I'm normally thinking about like the arachnophobia and the, you know, the things like that. Like, I never in a million years would have imagined that there's a fear about, you know, the wine glass running empty. Like, that's just something I never would, you know, think about. Like, to me, every time I pour a glass of something, I know it's going to come to an end and I'm going to go right back and do it. If I could have a never ending cup of coffee, that'd be great.
Yes. But you also have to remember that a lot of phobias are classified as an irrational fear of.
Yeah.
So, I mean, whereas we feel 100% scared of what we're scared of, most of the time it's pretty irrational and it can't actually hurt us. Some of the times it definitely can. Mm-hmm. Like, snakes could definitely hurt you if it's the right ones. I mean, so we just have to kind of remember that they're not always logical, which is kind of the fun aspect of our show. If we did an episode on the wine, I would rate that person as crazy because they're being ridiculous.
So, frequent podcast that we do all kinds of stuff with. He's also a writer, and he wrote a short film last year that we actually got the chance to review on our YouTube channel. And it's called Inside Guy, and it was about, you know, the fear of being intimate with someone. And it's called genophobia. And to me, like, I had never heard of it before. So the thing that I enjoy about your show is that I'm hearing about fears that I never knew were real. Like, I never knew that people could be afraid of moths. I knew that people, like, might not like moths, but not necessarily that people could fear moths, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And when we did that show, those are the types of cases that we covered. In my episode, we covered people that would get nauseous just at the sight of like certain patterns, which I experienced myself. So it's crazy the things that people can be afraid of. But we have to remember that we don't cover just fears, we cover the disorders. So maybe we can help give a person a better understanding about a disorder that they're going through. Like, one of the ones I saw was someone having the sensation that a part of their body isn't actually a part of their body. Like, from your knee down is not you. And like, these people go into the emergency room and ask for surgeries, or they cut them off themselves and then go into the emergency room. So our overall goal is to cover like all of these sorts of topics. And we're actually going on a road trip here next week. Mm-hmm. And we were going to record an episode while on the trip. And we're trying to think of maybe a road trip type topic. So if there's any suggestions out there, definitely let us know.
Yeah.
Sure. And so you guys are so let's kind of talk about the other side of that diagnosing and the more logical. Why do you think it is in your guys' personal
traumas?
Even from what you guys,
yeah, most of them really weird ones, traumas in their like childhood, I'd have to say.
Yeah, that's been the most common background that we've noticed. But some of them just like develop over time too.
Yeah.
So really, you can get a fear at any point.
At any age.
And just like when certain disorders like come to be in your early 20s, or maybe you get this after the later part of your life.
Yeah. But you're also living your life, so you'll come across different situations that could trigger a fear. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Megan picked up her fear when she was just a little kid.
Yeah.
And mine happened last year, and I was 23, so.
I guess that's fair. And we're here talking all about Waco tonight. So the one thing that I kind of want to open up is for the listeners at home, and maybe you guys know this, maybe you guys, some of you guys don't, but we are the final vision that we have for the next evolution in our four victims and villains is to become a nonprofit to actually get mental health resources into schools, because we believe that, you know, curriculums need to be taught on these things. And so with that being said, we're here tonight talking about what many people would perceive as a cult. When do you think, and I mean, this is a part of U.S. history, and there's so much of these things that are part of U.S. history as well that have just happened in the last 50 years. We've seen uprises in you know, the cultic lifestyle, whether you're talking about Jonestown or you're talking about the Manson family, or even Waco, what we're here talking about tonight, or the PS Midnight cast covered. Heaven's Gate cult as well. So, you know, with all of these in our history books now, like, when do you think we should start actually incorporating these into schools and teaching kids about this part of history?
You know, I think that, like, I think an older kind of subject, like a middle school age, but on the mental health aspect, I think that those need to, stuff like that needs to be taught way sooner. Whether it's, obviously you would have to make a learning type plan for specific age groups, but I don't think it would hurt to put some type of mental health teaching, whether it's like signs of depression, because we know that suicide rates are amazingly high, and just all that kind of stuff can save a young person. So I personally think the earlier we get the mental health in there, the better. As for cults, I mean, that can kind of come in whenever.
I mean, I guess what I'm also trying to ask is, do you think that we should teach these things in cults? Because what you find, at least in my research, is things that deal with mental health. And I think that there's a lot of, you know, psychological or disorders or psychology that's involved in these, you know, how cult leaders attract their followers, how they become leaders. I think that, you know, if we're looking at, you know, things, people like Charles Manson or Marshall Applewhite or David Koresh, we should start teaching these kids the warning signs so that we can see things like cults dissipate. That way they're not a part of our history anymore. That way that, you know, we're not seeing these anymore, because there's just some crazy outstanding cults that have just kind of come throughout history that we're just not talking about.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
Megan, what do you think about that? Yeah, nothing. Okay. I agree with you. I think it's important that the young people today, no warning signs of cults. But I also, I think that to be in a cult, to me, a follower is either looking for something to believe in, or they're easily manipulated. So I think it also, once again, comes back down to the teaching the mental health, trying to like strengthen mental health. And would, to me, I think that would stop kids or young adults or whoever is being confronted by a charismatic cult leader. And that's maybe trying to get them to join. Because if you have that strong mental health, you know kind of the signs to look for, then you won't get manipulated as easy, hopefully.
Yeah, and I feel like this series that we're getting ready to jump into, there's a scene, the David Thibodeau character, just throughout the entire series, like, you can tell that he's very split. You can tell that he wants to kind of believe it, but at the same time, you can tell that he's also questioning everything that the leader of this group is having.
Yes, and I love that about his character, mm-hmm. because there's nothing like following a character in development, but also to have, because as a viewer, you know this is a cult, and you're like, well, why? I don't understand what these people are thinking. Why would you want to do this? And then you have a character that you're going on that's literally questioning the same thing you are, but is still kind of going along with it, yes. as you kind of are while sitting there still watching.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice to have a character that you could easily relate to in the show.
Right.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, so we want to reach out to you guys and you as the listener and tell us, what is it about cults that you think that should we teach them in school? Should they not be taught in schools? So you guys leave a comment below on this episode. Write to us on Facebook, at Victims and Villains, or even on Twitter, at Victims and Villains as well. But what were your guys' thoughts on the Waco 6-part miniseries that ran in January to February? You're talking about it this week with the celebrating the 25th anniversary. I guess it's not really celebrating,
yeah.
but honoring. Yeah. That's a poor choice of words. What are you guys' thoughts
Addicting?
On the series then?
Oh my gosh, I loved it. I wanted more. I would have been, I loved what I got, but I would have been way happier if I had a little bit more, like on the earlier aspects and background. David,
mm-hmm.
if they could have made it 12 episodes instead of 6, kind of like a Netflix season, yeah. I would have been way happier. But that's just because I super liked it.
Yeah.
I also watched it before researching about Waco. I knew that a Waco incident happened, but I didn't know a whole lot about it or about the cult. So when I was watching it, I was like 100% on the cult side. I did not see why this was happening. I thought it could be resolved peacefully, and I thought that the whole siege thing didn't even need to happen, that they could have gone in there for David, specifically on the child abuse and polygamy, got a search warrant, and then looked for the weapons. So me watching that first, I probably liked it maybe a little bit more than someone who knew about it and saw that the miniseries maybe favored
yeah.
the cult side.
I mean, I don't know. I did my research before I watched it, and I liked it just as much. But I even said, like, within the first two episodes, I was like, oh, they're going that way. Like, it was a completely different kind of feel.
Than researching. Yeah.
It. Yeah.
I thought it was a well-balanced show. I thought that, you know, you got the side of the FBI, but you also got the side of, you know, what it was like for the Branch Davidians, because I did think that, you know, they were a little bit sympathetic
yeah.
to these guys. Especially the last episode, you can just kind of see that at this point, this is normal. They've grown accustomed to the sounds of, you know, the psychological torture that they're implementing of dolphins and kids screaming. It was just like, oh my gosh, so that was weird. Horrible. Like,
yeah,
I would have been out so fast. Peace. Like 20 minutes in, I would have left.
Yeah. No, gosh, you gotta have sleep.
Yeah. At least they weren't playing it during the day, and they could have played it 24/7, honestly. But in, at least in the miniseries, they didn't play it during the day, so you could have slept during the day.
Mm-hmm. You could have, and I think that, you know, one of the strongest points of this series is the whole aspect of, you know, them embracing this event and being honest about it, because you could have easily have gone into, you know, this event and just painted it in one favor or another. I felt like they had that nice balance, but not only that, I felt like adding in some of the scenes with the Thibodeau's mom and even Koresh's mom at the same time, their storyline I felt like was some of the most most relatable, because, you know, behind every villain there's always a family. There's always a origin and upbringing, and I feel like, you know, we have a tendency not to really flesh out our characters, but I felt like their arc together had some of the best, like, grounded nature about the series. And the first time that they meet, I remember that episode ending and just, like, having to, like, walk around and pace because I was, like, overheated just from, like, I was like, wow, what just happened? Like, I felt for Thibodeau's mom, just, you know, standing right next to Koresh's mom, and just that, all that anger flourishing through your body, like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't even imagine standing next to the woman who gave birth to the man who caused all this,
right?
But I really liked how patient they made Koresh's mom, and I hope that's how she was in real life if that happened, because it was nice of her to kind of wait out Thibodeau's mom's anger, offer her a place to sleep if she needed it, and some help. Just because her son turned out to be the way he did does not mean that she is a bad person, and it was nice to see that they allowed people to realize that on the family aspect.
Yeah.
But it also took a long time for her to get there, because you realize that it wasn't until that she got to the point of desperation that she came in, and the scenes where they're sitting there kind of watching the news footage in the, it was either the last episode or the penultimate, but that was, I think, one of the hardest moments for me to watch as a viewer, because I relate it with, you know, like, can't relate. I can't relate because I've never had anyone, like, go through this Waco siege thing. But I felt for them. Like, you know, I felt for it because I've invested all this time so far into these characters, and to, you know, just, I've lost people to, you know, cancer and suicide, and it's one of the hardest feelings that you just overcome. And, like, you know, when they're announcing all the survivors list and David Koresh doesn't make it, they, you know, you have Thibodeau's mom is, like, all excited that her son made it, but, you know, how do you kind of bring sympathy to a person that is the reason that your son was in that situation to begin with?
Yeah, that was a really beautiful moment, I think, of compassion. And
yeah,
I can't imagine how they felt at all. Mm-hmm. I don't have kids personally at this time, and so I can only pretend like I know what kind of feeling you would have during that whole situation, and trying to show sympathy towards a person who you still somewhat blame, but also being the mom that everyone hates because of your son. I couldn't imagine that either.
Yeah.
It's a heavy thought, but we are going to be right back. Welcome back. All right, we're still hanging out with the ladies of the Crazy Clinic podcast, and we are still talking about Waco, the 6-part miniseries that aired earlier this year. And I just have to say this, that when we originally planned out this crossover, we had met, we actually had planned on doing a lot more of the research side on our end as well. But the ladies over at Crazy Clinic did such a great job with their episode that I didn't want to take anything away from it. So we're focusing mainly on the series for this one. And you can't have a series without a star.
Oh, my.
And so you have, here you have Mr. Taylor Kitsch as David Koresh. So what did you guys think about
him? I love him. He's the reason why I watched it. And where I was like, oh, right, I remember seeing that, and I wanted to see it, because I love this actor.
I love him also. And he's in so many good films, and the TV show. But what I like most about this is that he's more dynamic of a character. He did a super good job, because he usually plays, like, the pretty boy, tough guy, football star, that kind of kid. And so this role was new, and
he killed it.
Yeah, he was charismatic. He was creepy in a nice way.
Yeah.
I think that he did a really good job, and I hope to see more things like this from him, and him not revert back to just his pretty boy type jock role that he usually gets.
Well, he has so much range in this thing, because he. Not only, like, I don't know if it was, like, within, like, the first, like, 30 minutes of the series, you see him, you know, take to the stage. Music was such a big part of David Koresh's life that they introduced him doing music for very early on in this. And I liked that aspect of it. But also at the same time is when you first meet David, you can... He's just such this charismatic guy, like you were saying, and he's just so full of charisma. But if you guys haven't watched Waco, let me describe it to you this way. His arc in this is very similar to Jesse Eisenberg's from Lex Luthor from BVS, where this is how he is. You know, he's full, like, he's kind of like a little bit smart. He's, you know, kind of, you know, he's kind of quirky, but kind of charismatic at the same time. And then slowly, as the arc progresses, you slowly really start to find out how unstable he really is. And I love that. That was the aspect of it that I love the most, because he unhinges with every episode. There's just a little bit more unhinged. But not only that, you know, he brings an intensity to the role. I mentioned this on your guys' show, the ice cream with, you know, was just one of the best scenes that showed you really how well he could do range and possibly how crazy Koresh really was.
Oh, yeah.
He'd go from nice, super, super nice, and just, like, it just eases into the show, too.
And it wasn't just like, whoa, maybe he's unhinging, he's crazy. It was an eerie type way that he went about unhinging each episode. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you brought up the music thing, because another point to Taylor Kitsch, he actually learned to play guitar for this miniseries. And that was, like, one of my favorite. Yeah, right?
Awesome.
And that was one of my favorite scenes in the miniseries was when they get the generator to work and he uses it to play music in the middle of the night to drown out their music to, like, show his message more. I thought that was a great scene.
Yeah.
And the fact that Taylor Kitsch learned to play the guitar for this miniseries, more points to him for the effort that he put in. He did a really great job all around.
Yeah.
I loved that scene. I totally forgot about that scene, but that was probably one of the best ways to end that episode, where Wayne finally got the power running, and he comes and he's like, I know exactly what I want to do.
It was perfect. Yeah.
It was, because it not only that, but even as he's playing, you can see the unhinging mm-hmm. on his face and his body language. And I feel like not only does he embody Koresh in that fashion, but he also embraces the body language aspect of it too, that I feel like, you know, sometimes when actors portray these figures, body language, I don't really feel like is something that a lot of people think about, but, you know, a great example of it, when you watch Nightmare on Elm Street, there's a certain way that Freddy moves. And they tried recasting him for the second one, and they said that he just couldn't move the same. And so they recast, they worked and gave Robert Englund exactly what he wanted. And they brought him back for it. And so I think that even the way that he moves in a way, in this, the way that he played during that scene just showed the depth that he really brought to that
point. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I watched a few YouTube videos today, actually, interviews with Taylor about how he tried to watch as many of like the home videos that you could find to like match that kind of body language. He went so far as, I mean, he grew out his hair. That's his real hair that he has in the show. He lost, like, I think they said it was like 45 pounds. Cause I mean, he plays, like I said, a lot of muscly jock boy roles. Right. So he was pretty built and he slimmed down a lot for this role as well. So it's just crazy the lengths that he went to, which I know some actors go even farther, but this is Taylor Kitsch's first role where he's had to do that, I think, and he did a good job. Because like you said with the body language, I haven't seen any of the videos of David Koresh or any of those, but I can only imagine that that's exactly how he walked. He just had this way about him.
And, I mean, this is really, I would say, because I'm not as invested into his career as you guys are. I've only ever seen him in Origins. So I still defend him. I'm like, he was the best part in that movie because he was a fantastic Gambit. Say whatever you will about the film, he was awesome as Gambit. And I may watch it tonight. I don't know. But, you know, I really haven't seen him. So, like, when I initially, Megan, you said that this was, he was the reason you watched it. The reason that I watched it was because I love Michael Shannon. And Michael Shannon does a great job in this as Gary. But I walked out of this with a whole new appreciation for Taylor Kitsch just because of the depth and just the intensity that he brings to this role, because you're not just seeing a guy that is just playing David Koresh, you're seeing an embodiment of David Koresh. And I think that when you can an actor can lose himself in that role the way that Taylor does, it's amazing. And it's
awesome. Yeah, it was beautiful. As beautiful as an actor being a creepy cult leader can be, that's how beautiful it was.
Yeah.
It is, and, you know, he demonstrates so much different, like I said, he has so much range in this, and what is your favorite moment of Taylor in this miniseries?
Oh my gosh.
I know,
there were so many good ones.
I mean, I guess I could say the first time I had felt like, oh, wow, I think he's crazy,
mm-hmm.
you know, was when they had went across the street to visit their new neighbors.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it was the ATF investigators. And when they were inviting him over, he just crossed this line when he was, like, telling him, oh, yeah, you could come over. It almost felt like it was threatening, mm-hmm. but not at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I just remember, like, what the heck just happened.
Yeah, and Taylor Kitsch as David Koresh, he had some super strong moments, like that one.
Yeah.
The music scene in the middle of the night, like I said before, that was my favorite. And just the way he like, you could see how angry David Koresh was. Like, he portrayed anger, but he was still getting his message out there. It was like, I'm not going to back down in your face. We can be loud, too. Like, to me, that was Taylor's, like, I really liked that strong point. But there were so many other subtle ones.
Yeah.
Like, when he would...
When he was explaining to Thibodeau.
Yeah.
Like when right they were the on the roof and they were talking, he's like, you know,
oh,
should
okay.
stay.
Yeah.
And that part is
even in the end when Thibodeau wants to leave and he's talking to him, David had this calmness about him, but you could tell that if Thibodeau did wrong, he might lose it.
Yeah.
I don't know which point was Taylor's strongest and the best for me. I liked them all.
He just did an amazing job.
He has this, like, weird... I don't really know how to describe it, like, but there's, like, this weird intensity to it. And I think one of the greatest, the best scenes that I'd forgotten about until Megan started talking about it was when they're all sitting in the sanctuary after the wedding. And... you know, they're all kind of sharing their stories about how they had met each other. And the ATF guy was like, you know, oh, that's crazy, you know. And David would just kind of turn to him and was like, you know, do you have a gun on you? Just like randomly. And he was like, yeah, give it to me. Like, there was just such an intensity about the way that he just delivered that line and just the way that his entire body demeanor went from, like, laughing and having a good time because, you know, they're all sitting around talking about, like, you know, how they all met each other. And most people have funny stories about how they meet each other. So, you know, it's mostly a good time, but there's just something about him that slowly starts to change as Wayne's talking. And when he finally addresses John Leguizamo's character, it's like...
I had really kind of forgotten about that scene until you said something. That was a really powerful scene.
Yeah, it was.
But gosh, he delivered his line so well throughout the whole thing. Like, when he needed to be that eerie, creepy, I'm the cult leader and it's my way, like, in that type of scene, he was. And he did it directly on. But when he needed to be the warm, charismatic cult leader, he could do that too.
Yeah.
Not only that, but some of his interactions with kids, the way that he would deal with his daughter when they would run every morning, or son, I can't remember which, his kid.
Sorry.
But that scene, and then as, like, all these kids are leaving, you know, leaving the compound, because 19 kids did leave the compound during the siege. When he's saying goodbye to all of them, that is just, there's just a gentle nature to him that David Koresh was such a complex character, and I feel like this guy, he just nailed
it. Yeah, I don't have any complaints on Taylor
Kitsch's
performance whatsoever.
Like,
I think
all of them did.
Yeah.
It was
very good casting.
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't, not only that, so not only did David Koresh's portion of the show, but we kind of meet early on in the series, we meet a gentleman by the name of David Thibodeau, who is hired essentially to be a fill-in drummer for the band, and him and David kind of get talking, and they stay, you know, one thing kind of leads to another, and he ends up actually staying at the compound, but... the way that it's introduced throughout the series, it's almost like the viewer's being sucked in, and you're Thibodeau, and you're experiencing all of this journey with them. And then at the end, there's a scene between the compound's on fire, and they're just right across the room with each other, and David Koresh just has this look in his eye, like anger and fire, and like, but it's like, it's not like an anger and fire, but it's like a I'm righteous in what I'm doing kind of look to him. And just kind of shakes his head. And Thibodeau just goes for the window and just escapes. And so taking this journey with Thibodeau, what did you guys think about that?
Oh, I liked
well?
It.
Yeah.
All the way from the beginning. Like once he introduced his name, I was like, oh, I have a feeling that we're going to be following him throughout the entire thing.
Mm-hmm. And like I said before, it was really nice to have a character that you could relate to more instead of sitting there questioning, why is she in this cult? Why would she allow David to marry her sister? Mm-hmm. Like all these types of questions. When you have a character that's literally in there kind of with you wondering the same thing. And I like that he stays almost to the very end, but when he's making that look and he like breaks it, it's kind of one of those things where it was a really strong moment for me as a viewer, being like, well, you're sitting there questioning that the whole time. Mm-hmm. If Thibodeau would have died in that compound, I would have been upset over that. Yeah. Because he was skeptical. He asked to leave. The only reason he didn't was because David wouldn't allow his second wife and child to leave with him. But the fact that he got out was really good to me.
Yeah.
Technically, Michelle was his...
Who was the second one?
The second one wasn't actually introduced in the series. The second one was actually, her name was Rachel, and she was 14 when she was young when they got married, but she slowly, she left, and she bore a son, left, and David tried getting rights of them to the son, but ultimately ended up leaving. And she also won, so Koresh didn't have anything to do with that kid. But, yes.
I totally forgot about that one. That's my bad.
No, it's all good. It's not acceptable. I feel like the Thibodeau character, though, I loved the fact that you kind of got to experience the journey with him, and you really do, because, like, you mentioned the questioning. I feel like a lot of times when I'm listening to a podcast that, you know, is talking about cults or watching a documentary, I ultimately find myself saying, well, why would people believe what they believe? And I feel like that is one of my biggest fascinations in life. And I love that you kind of get to experience this journey with Thibodeau, and not only past the fire, but also him being released from prison and going back to the compound after it's been burned down, and it's pretty much just like two walls and just laying in the rubble. I thought that was one of the best shots that they could have done, and the best way that they could have ended that series, because it started with Thibodeau. You know, the final shot that you're seeing is also with Thibodeau, because the journey felt complete in that sense.
Yeah, it did. And I honestly, I don't think the miniseries would have been the same without that character, because the people watching it wouldn't have had something to relate to. I mean, you can try to relate to the FBI side more, but they make, in the miniseries, they make some choices that if you're relating to the FBI, I'm questioning you.
Right.
the miniseries definitely makes the cult seem more favorable to me. They have those little things where in the miniseries, when they show everyone putting their gas masks on and laying down, you hear like the radio or something say that the FBI's reported the Branch Davidians are returning fire. In the miniseries, none of them are returning fire. So that like made me super angry. And
yeah,
there were just other little aspects like that. But bringing in the Thibodeau character, it was literally as a third party outside person that you got to follow along on the journey. And I love the ending, like you said, as well. And when he picks up the drum key that he gave to Serenity, who was Michelle's and David's daughter, I almost cried. It was so beautiful. And I knew it was coming, because he had to have, like, he had to end it with a piece to remember it by always, which it's not like he's going to forget.
No.
But you know what I mean? That token of the love that he could have had. So it had like a nice love story kind of ish in it as well. Only they don't go into it at all.
Right.
The miniseries was just, it was well-rounded on all aspects. I think they did a really good job.
Yeah.
It was a forbidden love, though. Like, you could see it throughout the whole series, but it was...
Yeah,
it
was and he was okay with that, though. He was okay with just doing what he was doing. You could tell.
Well, I think he was okay with it for the sake of... Because he wanted to be with her.
Yeah.
Irregardless of all the rules. But if he could have taken her out of there, he would have.
Oh, yeah, he would
have. I mean, I think even before they show him asking... I think every time he looks at her, all he was thinking was, we could just leave, and we wouldn't have to put up with this.
And I felt like, too, you kind of felt like there's that scene where Michelle and Rachel are actually outside. Rachel was the first one. There was a second wife, and then Michelle was the third wife. So I'm not sure who the second wife was. Maybe... apparently he was entitled to 140. But there's a scene where they're outside and this is kind of after her and Thibodeau go and get water for the compounds, and they're just kind of talking, and you can kind of see that there is that connection there, but they don't really want to, like, address it yet. And so she kind of is like, you know, well, why do I have to... She pretty much, is, in essence, said, you know, why do I have to be David's wife?
Are you talking... This is the scene where they're, like, taking the laundry down?
Yeah, and she's talking to her sister. Yes.
That, to me, that was a really sad scene.
Yeah.
Because you could tell that she...
She was upset about it. She's like, you let that happen to me when I was younger.
Exactly.
Like...
And then, but there was another, and of course, I can't place which part it was in, where someone asks her, Thibodeau, I believe, asks her, what's it like being married to David or something? And her response was super positive. And I can't quote the line directly, but it was something like being married to someone who's super special, but not being special yourself is how she put it.
Yes.
And... So she said that it was really good then, but you could also tell that even then she was still sad about that she even had to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, she was super young and doesn't really, I mean, she doesn't love David like you would love someone that you wouldn't marry. She loved him because she was groomed to her whole life.
And I think, too, that there's another scene in particular where Thibodeau walks her to her bedroom to talk Serenity in after the wedding, and David's like, all right, it's, you know, thanks for doing that. And so he takes her to bed, or like walk her to her bedroom at least, and she just watches him until she can't watch him anymore, and you can just see the heartbreak in her eyes.
Did he take her to her bedroom, or did he take her to his bedroom? Because it looked like, how I took it was that Thibodeau was taking Serenity and Michelle up to their room because they shared a room. And then here comes David about to bed Thibodeau's new wife, is how I took that.
Because it was like the wedding night kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I was not a fan of that scene. I don't know if I read the scene wrong, but that's how I took it. And I was very pissed off.
So I love the fact that and so I kind of want to address this real quick, because I thought that this series was super good done. It was fair on both sides. What I saw, what I've done research on, it looked like it was accurately portrayed very well. I think they had survivors come in and fact checked everything. But I don't know, was I the only one that was kind of like questioning the whole Steve and David scene? It was like, how do you know how it happened?
To be completely honest, there was one article I was reading that they were all fatally shot. Like, everybody that was in that died in the fire had a fatal shot to either the head or chest.
Right. And there's conspiracy theories, all over the place, where they say that the FBI went in and shot them and then put the, like, tear gas in there and fire to cover that up, and, like, so many different conspiracy theories. That, and I really think that, I mean, obviously we can't know if that's how that ending went down, but it was a nice dramatic ending. I'm rather bummed that Steve took his own life.
Yeah, because
I didn't think it was necessary on his part.
I really didn't. That actual scene is probably the scene I don't like. At all, because I liked Steve.
I thought he was a good character.
Yeah, he was a really good character. He was, like, one of my favorites. And the whole fact that he called his sister and said, "We're not a suicide cult."
Like, yeah, and then they show that he committed suicide. Yeah. So what happened, the shit? Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not us. We didn't kill ourselves. They're covering it up, kind of thing.
And then they show that he does.
Yeah, and I really didn't like that at all.
It did. It seemed like super out of character. And that was, I think, the hardest scene in the entire series for me to watch. Because, you know, he does, you know, go and say, you know, "Look, we're not a suicide cult," like you had mentioned, and to kind of go and do that. And
that actually is, like, what happened.
Yeah, exactly.
I really hope not. I hope that's not what happened. And did David Korsh get shot fatally and take his own life?
Yeah,
I
don't know. I heard that they were all shot, so that, you know, there's even a possibility that David went through and killed all of them and then killed himself.
Yeah, I've read that one too.
You know,
See, I would have liked to see that a little bit better, because I feel like that would have felt a little bit more in character, whereas Steve seemed to be, like, the head of the, you know, the communications for the most part. And I was okay with that.
Yeah. He was almost like, I don't know what the cult version for a patient liaison would be. He was the liaison between David and the cult, it seemed like.
Yeah.
He kind of kept everyone at their calm levels when people were starting to freak out.
Mm-hmm.
Even David.
Yeah.
So, I really like Steve's character. I don't think that they should have showed him.
I don't think it should have ended that way. Mm-hmm. I think if they weren't aware of, like, how that whole part happened, then I still think that they should have ended it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Because just, I don't know.
I don't know. Like, to me, I still think that I feel like the way that they portrayed David Koresh throughout this entire series, especially towards the end, was that he was very selfish. And I think that, you know, once they send Gary home, you know, the substitute negotiator is kind of like, you know, what I've seen is you don't care about anyone by yourself. I think that's an accurate description.
Yeah,
in all honesty.
But you don't want to tell somebody that's already, like,
yeah, for being a hostage negotiator, he screwed that one.
Yeah, like in 5 seconds.
And that was because he was listening to the FBI side that wanted to be pushy and show force. And, and then, like, when they show that scene where he's using the loudspeaker and saying that it's not an attack, well, what else do you classify that as?
Yeah.
First off, it was 100% an attack. Yeah.
If you have to wait, like, if they had to wait 2 more months, they should have. Mm-hmm. I mean, who cares?
Way too many people died.
They didn't. They could have waited. There was no reason to rush it just because.
The only reason for the rushing was because there was some higher up government official breathing down their necks, get this done, we're pouring money into this, I want it done.
Yeah.
And it's sad that's how it was handled.
Yeah.
And honestly, the government's pretty much that same way today. It all comes down to freaking money. So
yeah. So it's like that. It's a possibility, like, that the FBI just, like, messed up, because we can't trust our own government.
Now this is the podcast about conspiracy theories.
Cool. Awesome. I didn't know we were going to change subjects.
That's what we do. We come in and change everything.
That's cool. But sticking on the side of FBI, what did you guys think about the FBI perspective and the Branch Davidians perspective, did you guys feel like it was too one-sided, or did you guys think they did a nice even balance at the same time?
I think Gary was, like, awesome. I loved his character, and the way he thought about things is the way I think everybody should think about things. But the other FBI agents, they just seemed cruel to me. That's what I got out of it, was cruelty in a way.
Yeah. For, like, I don't know. I like that they balance. I like that you see from the FBI side. I like that you see from the cult side. In the miniseries, it gives it more of a well-rounded feel to it. I do think that the writing and the way they shot it favors the cult side a little more, not as like showing more, but by showing that David didn't look like he was abusing those kids.
No.
And then they showed the scene where the kids were outside playing in a park, and the hostage negotiator's character says, Gary, do these kids look abused to you? No, they didn't. No. But in real life, in the articles and everything that we read, the kids did show abuse for long before the siege happened. But in the miniseries, they don't show that, and they specifically say these kids don't look abused.
Yeah.
So I think the miniseries tries to show it in the cult being on the right a little bit more than the FBI.
Way more, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not 100%, but like 75%.
Right. Yeah. And I would have liked it to, because, I mean, that is one thing I feel like where the series kind of weakens is the fact that you are talking about, you know, yes, do these kids look like they're abused? No, they look happy, because that's how we like to do things. We like to be happy and positive, but at the same time, because, like I said previously, there was 19 kids that exited the compound during this 51-day standoff. And every single one of those kids, from the reports that I read, showed signs of actually being, hurt in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, obviously kids at that age, if they're told not to say anything, they're not going to say anything. And so I feel like in those aspects of it as well, but, you talked about Gary's character. I loved Gary's character in this, especially when they're showing the news footage at the end after he gets sent home and he's just crying. Like, that's all he can do, because they were so close at reaching a peaceful, just a peaceful area. And the reason that it took them so long to reach this was because there were kids involved. And he was 100% thinking of the kids every step of the way. And I love that the research I found that this series does so well again, too, is that you see a faction split off between, everyone's working together, but then you have Mitch on one side that's like hostility, brutality. And then you have Gary on this side that's like, we can talk this out and we can reach a reasonable conclusion. And I'm with Gary like 100% of the way. Like, I feel like if you could sit down and just talk to people, like, problems can get solved.
Yes, they can.
Conversations.
Yeah, 100%. And that is exactly why the FBI and other police departments and stuff like that have hostage negotiation. If it didn't work, it wouldn't be there. And the fact that they pushed it aside really upsets me.
Yeah.
Same. And so we were moving on to Roads to Hope. This is the point in our show where we engage with our guests of the week and talking all things mental health or finding mental health themes in the subjects we're covering. And David Koresh was a guy that was very, very well spoken when it came to how he could address people. It was part of his charismatic nature. And I feel like there's a lot of times in this series where he'll say something and I'll find myself agreeing as a Christian. And I'm like, wait, back this up. Nope. that guy is giving me exactly what I want to hear. And so there's a lot of dangers of words and how they're spoken, and the way that they come across. So jumping off of that point, what would you guys have to say about that?
I completely agree that there's dangers in words. It's definitely not just about what you say, but how you say it. We've all had the experience where you're talking to someone and they just have this tone in their voice, so you think they're upset or whatever. And maybe they are, but it could not be at you. I mean, how people interpret things straight up comes from how you're saying what you're saying. And people all the time try to manipulate and tell you what you want to hear or what you think you need to hear. And it can be super dangerous because a lot of people are like to just try to use words to get things from people.
I completely agree. You know, in this series, you know, talking about how words can really affect a person's decision. And I think Gary in it, he did a good job on the FBI side saying all that.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go to Steve's side and he had his way of saying that, you know, I believe in him and this is why.
Right.
And it was just kind of like, well, yeah, that's true.
I think that too, going back to the scene with all the guys where they're in the sanctuary and they're going, you know, sharing all the stories about how they came to know Koresh and how they came to follow Koresh. There's a scene where Wayne is talking about, you know, David is asking, do you know what the word Messiah means? And he's like, well, no. So he starts explaining what the word Messiah means, and it's exactly, you know, what he needed to hear. Or, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. It's exactly what he thought he needed to hear, I feel mm-hmm. like, in that sentence. Because there's a difference in between what you need to hear to get out of situations and seasons, and then there's what you think you need to hear. And David had a very probable way of telling you, speaking to you in words, and being so gentle with it that, you know, you couldn't help but like him. And I feel like that was probably one of the most dangerous things about him as an individual.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. He could, the way that, and of course I haven't actually heard David talk, but the way that it was portrayed in the miniseries, he could have told me anything and I would have listened.
Oh yeah, same like, here.
I would have 100% been sucked into that cult because his words were like butter. Like they were spread nice and easy, like... It was smooth. I don't know how else to put it. he really could have said anything to me, and I'd have been like, yeah, all right.
I'll join.
And it was all about his delivery, because I don't personally believe with any of the stuff he was preaching. It was just about his delivery, like, completely intrigued me and had me listening.
Yeah, me too.
I think too that it's not only, you know, that, but obviously it was the way that he was speaking and the words that he would choose to use, because you know, this series doesn't cover it, but in his history, a couple years before all this happened, there was this revelation that he had where it's called New Wives or New Light. It was the New Light revelation, and essentially what it was it was a portion of this. They're like the next step of evolution for the cult, and David essentially was going to take the burden of, you know, sex upon himself. He was going to have sex with all the wives, and he believed that, you know, God was going to birth the 24 elders that are mentioned in Revelation, and with that you know, they were gonna all come out of the cult, and he was gonna take, you know, he was entitled up to upwards of 140 wives, and men and women had to be celibate, and or the men of the group now had to be celibate. So it was just even those deliveries, because here you have people that followed him through that. Like, if someone told me that I could not sleep with my wife anymore, or that I couldn't be in the same room with my wife anymore without other people, it'd be bifurcated.
Yeah.
I love my wife.
Right. And to me, as a female, if my husband was like, yeah, babe, it's fine, you sleep with David now, I'm going to be celibate, I would slap him. What are you thinking? Yeah. I married you.
He must have the words that he spoke to those men to be okay with that.
Right. But I also feel like maybe he had that idea the whole time, and he knew that these people were right in the spot where he needed them, in their beliefs in him, that he knew that they would accept it.
Yeah.
Because,
he had that revelation too, there are a lot of people that left.
Yeah.
Like, because he was like, oh yeah.
That is true. So maybe he didn't plan it, and he did have a revelation.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it's bull.
And I think when you're talking about mental health, words really have more power than we lay them out. I've said it on this show a couple times. Words were a big factor in the reason that I got involved in doing suicide prevention, because a buddy of mine actually had killed himself because he was told that he was worthless and that he didn't amount to anything. And you know, there are people out there that are hearing that every day, and I don't really think that when we speak sometimes that we understand the gravity of the way our words can, or the tone in which we use, it has effect. And I think that, you know, yes, with what we explore throughout the course of the series, David was very dangerous in the words that he used. But, you know, as far as you know, speaking about, you know, mental health and talking someone out of, you know, suicide or depression or self-harm, people need to understand that this is a very real thing, and that with that there need to be very real conversations, and that those conversations, or the jokes that we, quote-unquote jokes that we say sometimes, they have words, they have weight, and they can completely derail the course of someone's life.
Right. And on that, with delivery of words, I just kind of want to note also that people need to try to remember that you never know what someone is going through. Just when you take your bad attitude towards someone and say something, maybe it's in your workplace, someone messes up a document or whatever that you need, you're already having a bad day, and you say something hurtful, or just calling him an idiot would be hurtful. Just like something like that, you have no idea what that person is going through, and today could have been the day where they had one foot out the door already. So people need to start thinking about not what they say just if someone comes to them with these problems, but all the time. You shouldn't be saying things that are hurtful to people, because you really never know when that one word is going to be the final push.
Well, yeah, and it's like a chain.
Yeah.
You make that person's day bad, they could say something to somebody else. Mm-hmm. Why instead just, like, lift them up?
Exactly.
And let them pass that forward.
Right.
Yeah, so words do go a long way, and, you know, because, you know, we see this with Waco. You know, these guys left everything for this teacher, and some followed him to death. And, you know, you just see the power of that words have. And so if you guys are listening to this right now, and you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please know that there is hope. And we're not just putting this content out there to blow smoke up your butt, but whatever season you're going through, there is an end to it. And we want to be here to to guide you through it, whether it's as a friend or it's to answer questions or even to connect you guys with a counselor. You guys can reach out to us on any of our social media. Call the Suicide Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. Also texting anonymously to 741-741 because suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 123 suicides that take place each and every day in the United States. And for every successful one of those suicides, 25 more being attempted. That's 3,075 suicides attempted every day right here on our own soil. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides, equaling one death roughly every 40 seconds. So if you or someone you know is struggling, I encourage you so much to reach out. But speaking of social media, where can people find you?
Yes, we can be found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Crazy Clinic Pod. We also have a website, www.thecrazycliniccast.com. You can email at thecrazycliniccast@outlook.com. We are always available if you need someone to talk to as well. And Josh here mentioned the hotline and the texting, but you can also go to crisis.org and chat with a counselor as well instead of calling or texting.
Right, and that's I love the way that technology progresses and times in favor like that. So we encourage you guys to reach out. If you guys have seen Waco, what did you guys think of it? Let us know. If you guys lived through the Waco siege, what was it like on the news? How crazy and chaotic was it really? Give us some inside scoops. And I thank you guys so much for hanging out with us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if we were talking to listeners or us for a second there.
Thanks. I always say
thank you for inviting us. This has been a wonderful experience, and we would look forward to doing more crossovers with you in the future.
Yeah. Agree.
Yes. Hands down. So if you guys have seen Waco, if you guys haven't checked out the their portion of the crossover, click the links in the descriptions below, and please go check it out because we had such a fun time over there, and they went head over heels on an excellent job doing the research and the psychology behind David Koresh and the cult. So I cannot recommend their show enough. Go follow and subscribe to them. But that is going to do it for us. So until next time, remember, keep talking nerds, talking hope, and speaking nothing else.
Bye.